650, Jamie Dodd, Thomas Trance. We are live from the Mobile Kintech Studio here at Rogers Arena. 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line, Metro Vancouver's trusted choice for contractors and rental warriors for over 50 years. Visit them at one of their three locations to serve you or online at dunbarlumber.com. This hour of Canucks Talk is brought to you by Rack Steel. Rack Steel offers industry-leading heli forklifts and engineered racking solutions. Visit them online at racksteel.com. We'll be joined by Sean Gentile momentarily here from The Athletic as we look ahead to the Four Nations final on Thursday. Canada and the U.S., of course, big rematch from the round-robin game on Saturday. And a few eyeballs are going to be on that one. Do we have Gentile ready to go, guys? All right, now joining us from The Athletic, one of our favorites here on the show covering the NHL, he is our pal, Sean Gentile. What's going on, Sean?
You guys played me into very mellow music. I wasn't anticipating that. I thought we were getting aggro for...
I don't know, maybe we're trying to lower the temperature, but that doesn't sound like Drance, so I don't know. I don't know what we were going for there.
I know how my man operates. I was shocked to hear the smooth playing song.
Yeah, we were trying to catch you off guard. So, Sean, what makes this American dominance of the round robin different from all the other times that America dominates in the round robin round?
Oh, I can sense the tone already. I love it.
I'm just saying. How does a country that never seems to win these emerge with such a like front runner vibe as a national character for their hockey team?
I think a lot can happen in 8 years. Is probably the best answer to that. Like, we've seen a pretty legitimate uptick in the quality of the players that are on this roster and the overall vibe surrounding American hockey over the last 8 years. And a handful of WJC wins will do that. And, you know, the emergence of players like the Tkachuks and Austin Matthews and Quinn Hughes of the world will have that effect too. So I think when you have 8 years of built up momentum, you know, it makes it easier to make that jump. Cause it's honestly strange to, you know, even relative to the 2016 World Cup or whatever it might be, to see how the vibes, you know, changed over the last little bit.
Well, I mean, we all want to see Quinn Hughes play. I even think the most heavily partisan Canadian hockey fans want to see Quinn Hughes play because the idea of dropping Makar and Hughes into the sort of environment that we saw on Saturday night, like that's what we all want. What's your sense? What's your guess of how you expect this to all unfold? How does the NHL make it so that the U.S. gets the exception that they wouldn't give Canada in you know, the Harley thing?
That's a good question. Someone else left. Jake Sanderson left that Sweden game, I think. Like I hear, or there were,
yeah,
there were other guys besides McAvoy who, you know, didn't come out of that game 100%. So I'm thinking maybe that's how it happens. You know, it's like, oh yeah, something nagging from that last round robin game. And then, you know, Quinn can just kind of parachute in there. I'd be surprised if it didn't happen, honestly. Like it's really not the same because, you know, like Makar was obviously legitimately out, which is what led to Harley ending up in the mix there. So I'd be stunned if there wasn't some way for that Quinn ended up in the lineup since he's physically in Boston already.
Yeah, we're not sure about that. We're Canucks practice at 2 p.m. You know, I was reading a lot into Mike Sullivan saying he's coming as opposed to he's here. So I'm curious to know exactly where in the world Quinn Hughes is.
Yeah, that's a fair question, you know, and I read maybe a little bit too much into what Sullivan was saying too. I figured he was, you know, obviously maybe not in the building, but maybe physically en route at that point. Mm. Who knows? Yeah, that's a good question. I guess we'll have our answer to it relatively soon.
I'm really curious though. Like, it seems additionally absurd to me, given that Sanderson is the Quinn Hughes injury replacement, that they couldn't then be flipped now that Hughes is healthy. That seems preposterous.
It feels like that. That's what I was assuming was going to happen. Like, I figured we were going to find out today that Jake Sanderson, you know, woke up with a stiff neck or something, and you know, that hasn't played out that way. So it is interesting.
He's got patrioticitis. He's just doing it for his country. He's willing to do it for his country. He's sick now.
Yeah, yeah, he's walking around TD Garden, you know, eating old food and looking going off. Just hoping he gets like a stomach virus in the next 2 days. Yeah,
yeah, eating a lot of gas station sushi, trying to see what he can do to help his team out.
How old's this lobster roll? Perfect.
Oh, it's from 2 days
ago. Doesn't matter.
Sign me up.
Room temp, my favorite.
Yeah, I mean, it feels like one way or another, Quinn Hughes is going to feature in this game, right? For him, like, and I get it. He wanted to be in this tournament so badly, so he's going to take any chance he can get and go out to Boston. But, like, he's going to Boston. There's injury questions. There's, you know, everyone knows the NHL is making it up on the fly here, which is totally fine. I'm not even saying that as a criticism, but it does feel like one way or another he's going to feature in this game. Now, beyond Quinn Hughes and his status and whether or not he does get into the game, what are your biggest concerns for Team USA going into the rematch with Canada?
That's a good question.
Goaltending.
Connor Hellebuck's been great and whatever. I feel like I've just I don't want to slag Connor Hellebuck, but like we've seen him struggle in the last couple postseasons for Winnipeg, and I'm still just a little worried that we're gonna see that version of him show up. Now the caveat there is he's playing in those series for Winnipeg behind, you know, a typically flawed team, and he's usually playing his 75th game of the season.
Yeah,
or whatever.
Yes.
So he's at a different point, you know, maybe in terms of his wellness or rest level or whatever. But I think it's fair to say that they're going to need Connor Hellebuck to be at his best. And, you know, if anybody who's watched him in the playoffs over the last couple of years, I think should know that that's not necessarily a given.
Would you say that the history of the Canadian-American hockey rivalry is pretty similar in a lot of ways to, like, Clippers-Lakers?
Mm. Yeah, and we're watching, like, the Lob City version of the Clippers right now, right? Like, this is Blake Griffin and Chris Paul.
This is the real shot.
This is it, right? And we know how – we also know how that played out for Lob City, right? Like, I get why you're choosing that specific analogy.
We can go Bears-Packers. You want to go Bears-Packers?
Well, but now the Clippers have the new arena with so many toilets, right? So things are looking up for
them. That's true. They really are.
Magic. Tons of screens. Yeah, yeah. Right.
Much better than stealing Luka Doncic.
Maybe it is Bears-Packers because there's some Bears success back in, you know, the pre merger days that you can maybe port over and compare to 1980.
Yeah,
like prehistoric success. But other than that, it's been one team all the time. Yeah, I think I like that one a little bit more maybe because the Clippers, man, the Clippers are always going to be the Clippers on some level.
Yeah, because I think that's really the, like, I mean, for Canada, obviously, the biggest concern, I think, there's some affiliated ones with, like, size, right? I thought the U.S., even beyond the fights, whatever, I thought the U.S. managed to, like, slow the game down in the second period, right? There was, like, 25 minutes in the second period where the U.S., and they weren't, like, generating a ton for their zone time, but they were able to use their size to just maintain possession and sort of take the air out of Canada's rush attack.
It brought the temperature in that game down, I think, pretty significantly there, and it was necessary. I agree.
Absolutely necessary. And then they emerge from it with a 2-1 win and play lockdown defense. So, you know, it's 2-1 lead, excuse me, ultimately a 3-1 win. So I do think there's an element of that. There's the goaltending. But I honestly think if I was an American fan thinking about what to be afraid of with Canada, more than anything, it's that Canada's the magic team. They just always seem to pull these out. I don't know why, but they just always seem to across, you know, 25 years. Not always. I mean, there's obviously 96 and 2006 and on, or 98, excuse me, 96 and 2006. So not always, mm-hmm. but more often than not, Canada finds that like Real Madrid gene and they just pull mm-hmm. it out with some massive moment. As a longstanding, like very patriotic American hockey fan, how do you regard that element of sort of the risk that Canada, sort of the threat that Canada provides going into this final?
I think the reason that's true is they typically have the best players right. in the tournament. Like, not to be reductive, but that's the way it goes. And I think it's really, to some extent, it's certainly still true. Like America doesn't have Connor McDavid and Nathan MacKinnon and Sidney Crosby. Like, good as Matthews and maybe the Tkachuks in this context are, like, they can't quite match that. And their production, but their production and how they've looked kind of a little more anecdotally in this tournament backs that up. Like, Canada's big boys have been their big boys. And I think that's always the trump card that they have, is the fact that, you know, they've got the best players of the last two generations involved with this game. Like, the storylines are clear. And I think, you know, the narrative element is always going to favor Canada just simply because of that, because we're accustomed, I certainly am, to, you know, watching Sidney Crosby win games
yeah.
and be the difference maker. Like, he's that's been true for literally his entire career, whether it's internationally or otherwise. And I think it just makes it easier for sure to see that kind of winning out, because it's basically been true, you know, for the last 20 years.
Yeah. That Crosby mystique. I mean, it was on display certainly in the game against Sweden. I mean, obviously Canada, you know, finally dropped a game with him in the lineup for the first time in forever.
The game against Finland, the US, though, the empty netter. Well, 'cause it's a 4-3 game. So
yeah.
That's the moment when even the highest level pro hockey player
uh-huh.
might get a little bit tight.
Yep.
You know what I mean? Like, no matter who you are, at that moment, you've seen a 4-0 lead evaporate. Finland's got this 6-forward approach that's actually looking dynamic as anything. And that read that he makes to check Granlund in the neutral zone, that's like the ultimate thing you're coached not to do.
Yep.
Aggressive moment. You need to be, you know what, you don't just need to be an elite player to pull that off. You need to have, like, absolute balls of steel. And I think that's what that moment for me just reinforced about Crosby. It's like, when everyone else might be feeling the pressure, he never seems
to. And then the wherewithal to stay with the play. Like, to get back in the play, catch the puck, settle it, score is pretty incredible.
And it's also Sam Reinhart getting the puck back to him, right?
Yep.
Like, that entire sequence on that empty net goal, you guys beat me to it. I think that's what we're talking about in a nutshell, I think. And we had to do it, Drancer. I don't know if you filled out the poll that they made us do at The Athletic, but it's like, what was the best moment or the most memorable moment of the tournament for you? And I seriously almost wrote in the empty net goal. Like, I'm half facetious maybe, but not all the way. Like, that was it, man. Like, that's the sort of thing where you're like, you know, it does feel like at times that Crosby by himself is just, like, not wired to allow losses to take place in games like that. And I think that's always the trump card that, you know, a Canadian international.
Whoa, trump card. Not this week, buddy.
Freudian slip.
It's like instead of French fries, freedom fries. It's the freedom card.
It's the really good card you can play.
Yeah.
I think it's technically the Musk card.
Oh no!
Did we actually lose him?
how hilariously fitting.
Well, hello? Do we have him?
No, he'll call back.
Oh, wow. All
that
right.
Was clearly a... Damn, I guess we shouldn't get political on these airwaves.
Yeah, they're listening. We cut that off pretty quick. But I was going to ask him...
That was incredible comedic timing from our guy.
I was going to ask him, is there... Because he's based in Pittsburgh, of course, covering the Penguins and following the Penguins. is there an almost bittersweet element? Okay, we got Gentile back, so I have no idea what happened there. Things are getting a little heated here, apparently. But, Sean, I was going to ask you, you know, as someone based in Pittsburgh, who, as you said, you've spent a lot of time watching Sidney Crosby, is there an almost like bittersweet element to seeing him thrive on this big stage again, considering how things have gone for the Penguins at the tail end of his career, or what looks to be the tail end of his career over the last few years here?
I think on some level, maybe for some people, there might be, but I don't know, man. For me, it's been more sweet than bitter. I've enjoyed, you know, I'm enjoying the hockey that he's playing, and I'm glad he gets to experience this, and I'm glad that, you know, not to get mushy or whatever, but I'm just glad that it's happening. Like I don't feel any kind of negative tinge to anything that's gone on there. No, it's just been fun to watch, and it's a reminder to me. If there's a bittersweet element to it, it's that we haven't been able to see this for the last 10 years. Like that's where maybe we tap into the more negative end of things. But no, man, to see him thrive, I think anybody who cares about this franchise or about Sidney Crosby should just look at it as kind of some unfettered positivity.
So I've been workshopping a take that I want to run by you, Sean.
Let's go.
Okay. I think this is better than Olympic hockey, significantly. It's on at the right time. It's played on an NHL ice sheet, which is a way more entertaining, high-paced game. You never get three fights in 10 minutes. You get thrown out of the game. Like, there's no way you're getting players like Tkachuk, Miller, Hagel, Bennett, and Parayko dropping the gloves early in an IIHF game or a game played under IIHF rules. There's it becomes a special teams affair. There's all sorts of penalties, mostly ticky-tack stuff, stick fouls. Refs, you haven't even noticed this entire tournament. They've been letting them play. They've been calling the egregious stuff, and that's just about it. The NHL knows how to make hockey entertaining. Now, sometimes they don't put the players in the right spots to maximize that, as the last 9 years might tell us, but they're product, the actual on-ice product of NHL hockey is vastly superior to what we see in international competition, unless it's sort of this style of best-on-best. The league needs to use this, in my view, to educate the players about why the Olympics is overrated and lean in more to these types of events because, frankly, the NHL stages them better. What's your take on this?
I think the ice factor is pretty. That's something that I've been taken with too. I think I've just realized that I like watching hockey on smaller ice. And I'm not sure I would have said that in 2014 or whatever. I think that's a big factor here for sure. But I like the way this is all shake. Like this is proof of concept for the NHL, right? That you can have a non-Olympic international tournament played at NHL rinks and have it be killer must see, you know, there's no U23 North American team involved with this, which was one of the main gimmicks, I think, with the last World Cup. This is just four countries with strong rosters that are going out and playing hockey at its highest level. Right. So I think it bodes well, you know, for whatever happens with the World Cup, and I had to do some quick math there. I almost blew it. Like with the 2028 World Cup, like I'm as psyched for that now as I am going to be for the 2026 Olympics. So I think that's maybe the biggest win to come out of this for the NHL is like, we know now without a shadow of a doubt that the non-Olympic tournaments can be great because we're seeing that, you know, right in front of us over the last week.
Before we let you go, can I get your concernometer ranking on Elias Pettersson coming out of a massively underwhelming performance at the Four Nations?
Oh my God, I thought he was going to be better. It seemed like this was tailor made for him to, you know, get back to some degree of comfort level and kill it. And he looked lost at times in these games. So man, I don't know. We're going 1 to 10. Concernometer with 10 being the highest. We're solidly in the 8 range now, for sure.
Yeah, it was pretty startling. I mean, just to see in that last game against the U.S., they're down to 11 forwards, and he's, you know, under 10 minutes, barely plays in the third. In that situation, to not get used is very, very telling. Sean, always a pleasure to have you on, man, and enjoy the game on Thursday. I know we have different rooting interests, but hopefully we get a good one.
Yeah, fellas, I'm sure we'll talk about it real soon.
Absolutely, we will. Thank you, buddy. That is Sean Gentile from The Athletic joining us here to weigh in on the Four Nations. And, I mean, we got a couple minutes before we go to break here, but you brought it up. Elias Pettersson's tournament is over. And just, you know, the easiest way to say it is didn't make an impact. Did not make an impact in any way over the three games. And the most concerning part of it for me was, you know, I was joking about it, right? I had that flicker of hope after the Leafs game where he looked to be playing a little better. Okay, can he go? And he seemed to be in better spirits, certainly at the start of this event. Can he go? Can he use it as a springboard? And you heard a lot of positive commentary from the coach for Sweden, from the other players, how confident they were in him. And the fact that it went so downhill just over the three games, right, from, hey, you're our second-line center, you're playing in this spot, you're playing these minutes, to what I just said to Sean in Game 3, and yeah, it's a meaningless game, but you're down to 11 forwards, and you're under 10 minutes, and you barely play in the third, and you're just not a factor whatsoever. The fact that in this environment, the Swedish national team and the coach and the infrastructure that was very positive and had a lot of confidence in him coming into the tournament flipped so quickly to, this is not a guy who can help us win in this event. Like, that's very, very concerning and just a tough look for Elias Pettersson.
Yeah, and I think the Swedish team got ravaged by the flu from what I understand. Mm-hmm. I mean, scratching Mattias Ekholm, you know, that's not a performance-based decision by the coach. So we don't really know exactly how much things were, you know, pure hockey decision from our guy Sam Hallam, as opposed to, you know, this guy's not right. This guy's been vomiting in between periods. So, you know, presumably we'll get more details on that in the days ahead. But yeah, I mean, I guess it just comes back to, for me, like, I don't know what anyone expected given that he hasn't had juice all season. He just doesn't look like he can move right. So I thought you saw that again in this tournament. Indecisive with the puck, that's definitely part of it. And, you know, again, I come back to the OEL comparison that I keep making from his final year in Vancouver where, you know, I thought he still had game. He just couldn't get there to execute what he was thinking of trying to do time after time. And then he lost confidence in it, and it all sort of broke down around him. That's what I see when I watch Pettersson play right now. And that's a concerning analogy to draw, I suppose, for a 26-year-old player, right? That said, after getting bought out and having a healthy summer, OEL went on to play big minutes for a Stanley Cup winning team and has more than justified the contract that the Maple Leafs signed him to this summer. So maybe there's some silver lining there, but it's not a lot of fun right now.
We don't need to do a deep dive on it right now because we got to go to break, and we'll talk to Landon Ferraro on the other side. But probably about
we'll bring it up to Landon Ferraro.
But my own, like, I hear what you're saying, but my concern is that it bridges a summer for him. You know what I mean? Like, if you want the summer to be the reset, well, he's had a summer.
Well, and also, if rest was going to help, why did he play in this
so
tournament?
I'm not saying you're wrong, therefore, no. But it's like, there's a lot of competing explanations that all have flaws and holes in them.
To be
you know
clear,
what I mean?
I'm not even saying I'm right. Yeah. I'm just saying it makes sense to me that this is physical because he just doesn't have burst.
Yeah, it's just there's so many different things going on.
It's clearly more than that.
All right, we'll take a break in just a second. JanPro, from showrooms to stockrooms and everything in between, JanPro keeps workplaces tidy, clean, and disinfected. For a free quote, visit janpro.ca. Landon Ferraro joins us here. We'll get his thoughts on the Four Nations and especially how Canada can adjust to the defensive style the U.S. was playing in that game on Saturday. We'll talk about that and more with Landon Ferraro next on Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650. Welcome back to Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Drance here. We're live from the Kintec studio here at Rogers Arena. Kintec Footwear and Orthotics working together with you in step.
Before we get to... Sorry, do you have more reads? You can keep paying the
bills. Kind of. 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. There you go.
Canucks just posted that general manager Patrick Alvin announced the recall of Neil Zaman, Archdeep Baines, and defenseman Elias Pettersson from Abbotsford of the American Hockey League. Artur Shelovs has also been recalled on an emergency basis. And Nikita Tolopilo will join the team as a practice goaltender. So both goalies. That's the reason I stopped this. Both goalies. We knew Lankinen wasn't going to be here.
Yep.
But the fact that Tolopilo appears to be
practicing with the team.
Is that bad news on the Thatcher Demko front? We'll wait and see, but certainly not what you were hoping to see, an hour and 20 minutes before the Canucks take the ice at Rogers Arena for practice.
Yeah, we should mention the reason we're here is the Canucks practice at 2, which I think is like the earliest possible date and time they're allowed to practice. Yeah.
And then they moved their practice time to 2:20, which means we could have been in studio. I'd have had time to get there. I like it here.
Yeah, that's great. Rink? Love a rink.
It's great.
Anyway, so the Canucks will practice for the first time after the break today. But right now, we are joined here on the show, former NHL player, now an analyst on 650 on Sportsnet TV. He is Landon Ferraro. Landon, what's going on, man?
Well, not too much. Just hanging out. I'm assuming, though, everyone back at the studio enjoys when you guys were over at the rink.
Yeah, it's a huge bonus for them to get us out of there. Are you kidding? They love it. They're like, yeah, guys, go to the rink, man, just in case. Just in case you want to be there. How much have you enjoyed the Four Nations, Landon? Like, we've certainly been caught up in it. It seems like a lot of people, even those who are skeptical, have been caught up in it. How much have you enjoyed these games so far?
I've really enjoyed it. You're finally watching best on best, and that's coming from a guy that was lucky enough to take advantage while these guys weren't playing international hockey. And even then, I'm like, God, I want to watch them play instead. it's the reason they're the best in the world. Like, you want to watch the best at whatever they're doing, and this is the reason why. Like, the hockey's been amazing.
So, Landon, one thing that I knew I would enjoy about this tournament, but in some ways had forgotten just because it had been so long. But like the experience of watching McDavid at this level and how different it feels when McDavid's on the ice versus like perennial Selke candidate Anthony Cirelli and, a 40 goal guy in Brandon Hagel and, guy who's going to have 90 points this season in Travis Konechny, in some ways almost helps me appreciate the greatness of McDavid, right? Like, it's like, oh, it's not McDavid on the ice and then he takes a breather and it's, the third line for the Edmonton Oilers that comes on. Like, these guys are still star players, and the gap, I almost have like a better feel for the texture of it watching this tournament.
Yeah, like, and that's the best way of saying it, right? Like, you finally see the best in the NHL, essentially the world, playing in one tournament on teams, and all of a sudden, like, you get to actually see, like, when Connor McDavid winds up for a puck on the power play with Edmonton, like, it is so far a difference. And you just think, yeah, but, that's here, even though it's the best league in the world. And then you see it, and, the way him and McKinnon explode up the ice, and you're like, oh, they can do it against the best as well. And it's exactly what you said. Like, it just puts it into perspective, but, like, it just shows – again, like, how good the league is, the NHL, and all these players are amazing, but when they're lumped together, like, there's hierarchies at every point in the league. Whether you're a fourth line guy, like, there's the best fourth liner, and, the guy that's just holding on, well, there's the best player on each team, but, like, there's a big gap in that as well.
Yeah, and I mean, I think it's telling also you see, like, Braden Point getting moved up to play with McDavid, because that's one of the things with a player as fast as McDavid, who plays kind of such a unique style because he has the skill and the pace to do so. I think there was a bit of an adjustment period for the guys he started playing with, but you also then see, like, yeah, a guy like Braden Point, he has the smarts and the skill and the speed to be one of the few players who can kind of keep up and complement Connor McDavid at an event like this.
Yeah, and I think the biggest thing is someone that has hockey IQ. And, of course, all these guys have high hockey IQ. But for when you're playing with McDavid, like, just watching so many of his games, especially this year, and, watching, they've signed Arvidsson to come in and Jeff Skinner to come in, and both of those really didn't work out either. And, like, you can generally read what your line mate is going to do. But when it's McDavid, like, he sees holes and things on the ice that pretty much everyone else just doesn't. So trying to read off, like, okay, he's cutting to his right, well, I know he's going to go here next. Like, well, no, you don't. Like, you got to try and figure that out still. And for someone that, like Point, that has been, like, he doesn't need the puck on his tape really ever. Like, he can buzz around. He finds that open ice so well, and he only needs a shot or two, and he can score. Like, he's a real, real goal scorer. And just being able to read off of McDavid as he's flying around the zone and just find that open ice for that split second, he's going to hit you. And that's a player that can do it.
Landon, watching, you know, the sort of search to find line mates that have chemistry with McDavid at this tournament has sort of made me wonder, like, has McDavid reached the Crosby level where Zach Hyman just needs to be on this team? He gets the honorary Chris Kunitz. Like, give him the Chris Kunitz jersey number. Give him the same locker room stall. Like, we need to bring the guy who can compliment McDavid from the jump to this tournament going forward.
And I guarantee the people making the decisions are having that exact conversation, yeah. Right? Like, it's a proven fact that it works. And, you know, we've seen from teams in the past, and, you know, whether it's Canada or other nations, like, just because you put what is, you know, if you do blind rankings and just go off of that, like, if you just pick the best players, it doesn't mean that the team works. Like, there's a reason why, like, you bring up Kunitz, but, you know, like, the Drapers and the Malpe, like, these guys.
No, there's a reason around. I didn't bring up those guys.
Oh, yeah? Why is that?
Well, that's the 06 team.
Ah.
Right? That's the 06 yeah. team. I want to avoid that, but I think there might be, I'm okay with the Kunitz. I don't want Rob Zamner.
Yeah,
I'm okay with the Kunitz.
But, like, the funny part is like, we're talking about him, like, we're talking about Hyman, that he's not just finished a 50-goal year, and, yeah, he had a slow start, but as soon as his team was named, well, he's got about 20 since then.
Yeah.
So, you know, like, he can finish as well, and then, you know, not that, you know, like, the next tournament's going to be under IHF rules, and, like, there's not going to be three fights. That's just, well, I mean, there can be, but those guys are gone. So it's just, it's different, but, like, Hyman's still a good-sized player that gets himself to the front of the net consistently. He's heavy on pucks. Like, it's just another bigger body that can play when the game gets tough and it gets hard. He's not going to shy away. Not saying that these guys do, but I'm a big fan of Hyman, and I think that he could be a big piece of that.
Yeah, me too. And the other thing in watching McDavid in this tournament that has struck me, Landon, is I feel like in some ways – you end up with a team of all elite guys, and I worry that because of that, you have McDavid taking shorter shifts than he would in Edmonton, and to me, that almost neuters one of his superpowers. I mean, one of his superpowers is moves faster than anyone else on the ice and can make incredibly skilled plays, but his other one is he can still do that in the 100th second of his shift, right? And in this tournament, I feel like he's kind of changing the way he should change, but also the way he shouldn't change, right? Like, he needs license to stay on, because how many times do we see the Oilers just devastate their opponents with those shifts of incredible length? And for me, one of the things that Hyman does well is he can actually maintain the same level of activity across those extended absurd shifts. I just worry that Team Canada hasn't had enough of those moments in this tournament all told, and not that it's going to cost them on Thursday or that we need to have like a national symposium on this or anything, but just like as I'm thinking about how you construct a national team around McDavid going forward and sort of lessons from this for the Olympics, I kind of wonder if they need to lean into that aspect of McDavid's dominance.
Yeah, well, I mean, like, it is interesting watching the power play and him taking a regular shift on
it. Right.
Because you're right, like, you know, like, he had, like, what you were saying, though, of, like, you know, should they have, like, let him do it? Like, essentially, you're just saying, do they treat him like Rick Tocchet treats Quinn Hughes, and essentially just told him, if you feel good, just stay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like, we know you're our best option. The hard part when it gets to Team Canada is, So you have your first unit out there, and then all of a sudden, like, you're looking at that second unit, and, like, yeah, you could maybe pop them in, like, just keep one of those guys out, but, like, the team is so deep that the only way that he should stay is if they have that zone time, or it's going to be a really quick transition, and he knows he can catch that. Because then, like, the reason their power play works at Edmonton is because, like, they don't let the penalty killers change. Mm-hmm. And, like, now everyone's exhausted and it goes. So, like, if you can hold them in, I don't think it matters who's on the ice, whether it's the first or second unit. Like, you keep it, you stay out there as long as you can. Like, all of these players are Team Canada All-Star quality. Like, yes, he's Connor McDavid, but if the second unit's out there and they've got good possession and the killers are getting tired and there's a quick transition, like, why bring it back and let them change? Just go back in. Those guys are good too. But, like, I understand what you're saying, but it's a tough one. Like, I think John Cooper does such a good job of going off of feel as well as, you know, obviously tactically that he's, you know, so good at, but, like, just finding different moments of the game and just kind of leaning down and saying, like, hey, just go. Like, just literally, like, vocalize it and let them know, like, hey, like, I'm kind of unleashing you. Like, go turn the tides a bit. You know, like, I feel like that's the way you can do it. But I think it's tough just letting him run like he does back with Edmonton because there's just too much around. Whereas you're switching out, and no offense to the second unit in Edmonton, but it's not these players.
There's been a lot of talk throughout this tournament about the size factor and people talking about Tom Wilson and, you know, how the United States, I think the fights obviously and the Tkachuk factor is part of it, but I also thought the U.S. used their size in the area game to sort of take the O2 out of Canada's rush attack, especially in that second period on Saturday. One thing I've been thinking about a lot here as, you know, again, from the perspective of what this means for Milan, is sort of the importance of, like, Adam Fantilli and Dylan Gunther leveling up so that Canada can go to the Olympics with sort of their answer to what Matt Boldy, for example, has brought to that American roster in this tournament. How do you sort of look at the size conversation as it pertains to Thursday's game?
Well, for Thursday's game, like, it is the thing that I always, after a game that just happened, not that there's been three fights and that, but USA and Canada games get, you know, they get testy every time that they play, whether it's at U17 all the way up to the Olympics. Like, that's what everyone waits for. Everyone is so excited for the first time that you're wearing a Canada logo and you get to take a run at someone wearing a USA jersey. Like, it's the coolest feeling in the world. So, like, the issue Love becomes, it. And it's more when they're younger, but it can be the same here because it's, like, it's a final of a international tournament. These guys have been waiting basically a decade to do it. Some have never got to do it at this level. And they're going to want to show that they're not going to get run out of the building physically. And then, like, you know where I'm going with this with Team Canada is, like, they show that they're stronger and tougher, and then before you know it, they've taken six penalties. Right? Like, it's, you got to make sure that you have yourself pulled back in enough that you're, you know, being smart about it, but, like, you have to find a way to use your speed again to make their D turn. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm assuming Quinn Hughes is going to be in that game, which adds a whole nother element, but with the players that they've now lost, like, their back end doesn't look quite the same. They're not going to be able to transition pucks in the same way without Charlie McAvoy. Again, Quinn Hughes getting dropped in there throws a big wrench into that. But, like, for the other guys, like, you have to be able to spend some zone time. You have to be able to get to the inside of the ice because, you know, the way that the U.S. played last time, they did such a good job of holding it in Canada's zone. Canada finally gets it out. then they dump it in, they go change because they're exhausted. Like, they got to find a way to flip that a little bit.
Yeah, and, you know, I think about both McDavid and MacKinnon with their speed. Like, one of their signature plays is, you know, they come flying into the zone with so much speed, and then they stop up, and just inevitably the defender has to give them the gap. And so they've got time to you know, survey the ice and try to make a cross-ice pass and, you know, get the puck into the dangerous areas. But it seemed like even when they did gain the zone like that against the U.S. did a really good job of getting sticks in the lane and not letting them complete those east-west passes. And it's doubly frustrating for Canada, right? Because the U.S. played really well defensively, and then you've also got to beat Connor Hellebuck on top of that. So offensively, what would the adjustments that you see, what adjustments do you see for Team Canada, as you say, you know, to try to get into those dangerous inside areas to have a chance at beating Hellebuck?
Well, one, like, you got, especially early in the game, like, I think you got to shoot the puck a bunch, because, like, as you were just saying, like, they did such a good job of breaking up east to west plays, and, well, because everything's kind of on the outside and they're trying to go through. If you're that weak side winger, like, as long as you know where your D is up top, like, it's pretty easy to just stand there and move your stick from side to side and smack something down. But as you start shooting a bit more, especially in that type of environment, I couldn't even imagine with the emotion how loud it's going to be. But as those shots coming in and there's rebounds sitting there, hopefully, with Hellebuck, like, you got to be able to get in front of his eyes a bit. But, like, as those come in, now those wingers start to sink in a little bit deeper, and the rebound comes out, you can make that east-west pass. Like, it's about, you don't have to score that first shift, but you can start setting them up and making sure that you're pulling them as deep as you can. Now that lets your D-men kind of creep in a little bit more. Now they're, there's a quicker shot coming from the point instead of a block. You know, like, all those little things, but it's just about trying to get that puck to the inside and then get yourself there as well, because as long as it's to the inside, they're always going to beat. Not always, but they're going to beat the U.S. to the boards a lot. Like, Canada is fast, especially when you're on offense and you're D, or, you know, someone's taking a shot. You see it better because you're not looking for the defensive player and having to pick up a stick. You're watching where the puck goes. Like, you get the puck back a lot more. So if you can start doing that, well, there's some zone time as well.
How much of a difference is Cale Makar going to make in your view? I mean, I think especially with the ability to find chances on the rush, which I think is huge against Hellebuck, right? Like, yeah, you got to do the in-zone things you're talking about, but if you can get a couple of looks on the rush, that could be a big deal as well.
Massive. And like we were talking about it earlier with their speed, especially with McDavid and MacKinnon, the way that they can drive a puck, whether it's through the guts of the ice or cutting to the outside. But now you have a guy in Cale Makar is the one that's going to be following that play up. So, like, as you back them all up, well, you have an unbelievable player that's going to be coming down the lane. So, like, the way that he can get himself up ice, but also just the understanding of the right place to be for those guys. So as soon as they turn, they know exactly where he is, and they can get, make that pass across quick, and then he gets that shot off fast. So, no, you're 100% right. Like, there's, like, that's a huge piece coming back in. And again, like, just the way that he can skate just opens up so much more for the rest of the forwards as well.
Landon, really appreciate the time, man, and hopefully this game on Thursday delivers on the hype, because I think I speak for a lot of people. I am extremely, extremely jacked up to watch this one. We'll chat soon, man.
Yeah, have a good one, guys.
That is Landon Ferraro here on Canucks Talk, of course, former NHL player and now analyst for 650 and for Sportsnet on TV, weighing in on what he's seen from the Four Nations. And yeah, Canada's plan of attack on offense is going to be really, really fascinating. And, you know, this is a big moment for Coach John Cooper to see how does he make the adjustments, what adjustments does he make. And as I said, like, it reminds me a little bit of his Tampa teams, actually, in their cup winning years, where they were so disciplined and so in control, and then even if you got through all of that discipline and structure, you had to beat Andre Vasilevsky. And there's a similar dynamic at play here with the Americans, where it's like, man, they were really good defensively, and then also you're shooting on Connor Hellebuck. Now, if any team in the world that can be assembled has the tools to try to break that down, it's Team Canada with John Cooper behind the bench. I'm going to be fascinated to see how they try to do it.
Yeah, and I know Auston Matthews hasn't scored yet in this tournament, But the Slavin Matthews minutes were completely oppressive. Like, really had that same look and feel to it that those old Bergeron Chara 5-on-5 minutes did.
Or like Barkov Forsling.
Exactly.
Right, yeah.
And, you know, I think Matthews, you know, Matthews is maybe the hardest player on his stick in the league. You know, and you can see it. Like, sometimes there's his line mates actually send him passes into space, and he'll let the other guy get there just beforehand, and it's like, oh yeah, I got it. And then, absolutely, you do not. Quick stick lift. He's physically assertive, right? He's got that, like, his two-way game is, I mean, he's at the apex of his powers in terms of his two-way game, and I thought that axis, right, the ability to put those two out against at least one of McDavid and MacKinnon, and all of a sudden you go from Canada's unmatchable 1-2 punch to being like, okay, we're at least able to put a blanket over one of them, right? I thought that was a huge factor, and I don't know that that switches, right? It's just going to be, you got to find a way to beat those guys, and more importantly, you got to find a way to lead, because you really don't, or at least keep the game script neutral late, because you don't want, given the size and sort of like all defensive chops up and down this lineup, I don't think you want, you don't want the Americans parking the bus. They've got John Tortorella on their side, and John Tortorella, man, he can park a bus.
He's parked a few buses.
Guy knows how to. Guy parallel parks a bus. It's incredible.
Doesn't even need the other guy out there like directing him. He just does it by feel.
When you only got one game, you don't have 70 for his players to tune him out. So it's really dangerous in a short tournament.
And I did think the most telling thing for the U.S.'s defensive performance on Saturday was the fact that trailing late in that game, Canada couldn't take it over and turn it into a shooting gallery, right? Like, they didn't have that gear that you so often see from really good teams when they are down late, which is, okay, we own the puck now, and maybe we're not going to score, but we're going to give you absolutely everything you can handle, and
yeah.
Canada didn't really do that.
It would feel a lot different, though, if Doughty hadn't flubbed that pass to MacKinnon.
Sure.
You know, because, you know, you had the pass to MacKinnon that didn't quite go off, but you also had that McDavid chance in the high slot. And it's like, those are as good in a one-score game, McDavid and MacKinnon with the defense in duress in prime scoring areas. I mean, that's exactly what you want if you're Canada, whether you're generating six of them.
Yeah, there wasn't a lot of volume, though.
There wasn't a lot of volume, but those are brilliant chances. So it's not as if, like, don't let the result sort of confuse the fact that Canada didn't get anything. They absolutely had multiple glorious chances. They didn't go off, and I guess it is fair to say they didn't have enough of them.
Yeah. All right, we'll take a break here. We got one final segment coming up. We can maybe do a look ahead for the Canucks, what to watch for this week, maybe dive in a little bit as well to some of the business they still have to take care of with the Drew O'Connor signing in the books now. And we can do some big picture takeaways from what we've seen at the Four Nations as well. Get your text in, 650-650 to the Dunbar Lumber text line. Final segment on the break coming up here in just a second. However, before I do that, again, I have to tell you about Rogers Xfinity. Can't find the latest episodes of your favorite HGTV, Discovery, and Food Network shows? Rogers Xfinity TV has the newest seasons of the top-rated shows on these popular channels, while other providers are no longer including them in their TV lineup. If your TV provider doesn't carry these channels, you're missing out on new seasons of Celebrity IOU, Hometown, Beat Bobby Flay, Expedition X, and more. Don't be fooled by other channels pretending to be these networks you know and love. Get the latest with Rogers Xfinity TV at Rogers.com. Final segment of Canucks Talk next here on Sportsnet 650.
You want me to think that you're wild?
Welcome back to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. It's Jamie Dodd and Thomas Drantz. We're live from the Kintech studio. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Metro Vancouver's trusted choice for contractors and rental warriors for over 50 years. Visit them at one of their three locations to serve you or online at DunbarLumber.com. Canucks will hit the ice for their first post Four Nations break practice here in just under an hour, 2:20. And I mean, a couple of questions, and, you know, obviously we won't be able to answer them on our show, but we can dig into them tomorrow. But it'll be interesting to see if Quinn Hughes is a factor in this practice or not. You know, as you said, Mike Sullivan said that he is en route or coming, was how he said it, to Boston. But we don't know, like, what does that mean? Was he in the air? Is he still going to practice here? The game's not till Thursday, so there's some buffer, right? If he's even able to get into that game. Because if we hadn't heard that from Mike Sullivan, I mean, I think all eyes would be on Quinn Hughes for practice today, his health status, hearing from him about withdrawing from the tournament, all of that. You mentioned as well with both Artur Shelovs and Nikita Tolopilo coming up from Abbotsford. Seems to be not a great sign for Thatcher Demko as well, although we'll await more information on that. So still lots of Canuck stuff here. Go ahead.
Well, no, let's because I actually think the Demko thing is a huge story.
Yeah.
Okay, because dating back to March of last year, I guess March 8th was the game in which Demko got injured against the Winnipeg Jets, right? That was the initial lower body injury that put his status for the playoffs not in question officially, but obviously required a lot of work for him to get back. And we all know that once he did get back after two regular season performances, got injured in that first game in the playoffs. So dating back to that, we're talking about a 21-game stretch in which Demko has finished 18 of those 21 starts.
Mm-hmm.
And in one of the completed starts, sustained a completely unprecedented knee tear that took him out of action for 10 months. That, in the context of Kevin Lankinen, who took over for Team Finland and performed admirably, I think. Obviously, it got ventilated by Team Canada, but
yep,
that's going to happen, right? Especially given the state of that blue line. You know, I think the... I think the Lankinen conversation coming out of the Four Nations, and in particular the Demko question now, especially if he's having left that game with an injury. Rick Tocchet said he didn't think it was serious at that time. What was it? We're talking 10 days ago now.
Yeah.
And then to not be ready to practice today, I do think that starts to... if the flag's not red, it's pink. At the very least at this point, from a what's Demko's status, what sort of durability can we expect from the Canucks starter over the balance of the season, and how does that impact Canucks contract talks with Lankinen, and ultimately a decision that's going to start to be made come July 1 about whether or not to extend Demko himself. I mean, is that even a conversation you have if you're the Canucks at this point?
I guess you have to, but I really, like, you have to talk out, okay, what would it actually look like? You do, I think you just have to do your due diligence of at least exploring what that would look like internally. It's very difficult for me to see a world where that's your primary option, right? Where you're, or that's a priority for you. You know what I mean? Like, hey, this is something we actively want to do. Let's go extend this guy. I guess, is there some world where, you know, the durability questions are so serious that it reduces his value significantly, and that actually makes you interested in it, right? Or, but the idea that you're going to go in...
I still think you're a long way from there.
Yeah, but so the idea that you're going to go in on July 1st and, like, okay, we're treating this as our franchise goalie and we're going to extend him as such, I don't know how you get from here to there.
No.
I think it would be very, very difficult for that to happen.
Especially if he's about to miss time again.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
I mean, we're a week and a half out from him leaving that game. You know, and it looked from the warm-up video that we saw like a lower body injury. So, I mean, I do think at the very least we got to be looking at this as amping up the leverage, right, and importance,
yep,
of the Canucks extending Lankinen, especially because, and you know, Harmon and I wrote at The Athletic today about what the Canucks should do with Brock Besser, Lankinen, we touched on Pugh Suter. I think part of the Lankinen conversation that we're maybe not having enough is, you know, in addition to like the Mackenzie Blackwood effect and the Logan Thompson effect and the soon to be Charlie Lindgren effect in terms of spiking valuations for these quality 1B guys, I think it's worth noting too that there just aren't a ton of options about to be available in unrestricted free agency in the goaltending market. And I think that's going to cause, you know, Lankinen's leverage, for example, to spike even further. Aiden Hill is an expiring UFA. He's had a tough season, but he's also going to get another playoff run to show what he can do. I think he's pretty good. Karol Vejmelka is probably the other, like, top name on the market. I think he'd slot behind Lankinen. right? And there might even be teams that prefer Lankinen, given, you know, like Hill's blocking style versus Lankinen's sort of more well-rounded game. There are teams that might even look at Lankinen and prefer him stylistically, even though Aiden Hill's got the Stanley Cup on his resume. Beyond that, you get into like Alex Lyon, Jake Allen, Ilya Samsonov, and then you really get into like David Riddick, Dan Vladar, Alexander Georgiev, Anton Forsberg, guys who you're looking at to be like the next Lankinen.
Yeah.
But you don't want to come into the season necessarily counting on to be a 40-plus game guy. At the very least, the Canucks, I don't think, can go into next season, given the importance of appealing to Hughes, given the short-term priorities that this organization has, without a 1B type who you're completely comfortable with as a 45-game-a-year guy, yeah, just given all of the uncertainty that now surrounds Demko.
Yeah, it's a good point of looking at it, right? Because it's not just, okay, is Lankinen going to make sense on this deal and what can we get him for and all that? That's all important. But it's also, well, what are the alternatives?
Right.
Because I don't think there's any, as you say, I don't think there's any world where it's like, Demko and Shelovs, and here we go. You know what I mean? I don't think you can take that risk.
Well, and if that's a risk you feel you have to take, then we got to see, if you're the Canucks, we got to see Shelovs play another 10 NHL games. We got to see that, you know, the steadying of his game that we've seen in the American League is going to translate again
here. Yeah, that it's actually a viable option and not just a wing and a prayer.
Yeah, well, and
right?
Especially because, you know, the steadying of Shelov's game down in Abbotsford has been just that. Like, he's 906 across 14 starts for the Abbotsford Canucks. We're now at a point where he's played 103 games in the American League, right? 906 for his career.
Yeah.
That's not, no doubt, future starter production.
Mm-hmm.
Even though he's got no doubt future starter mentality, no doubt future starter athleticism, positional command, right? Like, all of those things are there. But he's also faced 2,500 shots at this point, right? Across, you know, 5 years in the American League. Like, at this point, we can say his sample of games at the AHL level is actually suggestive of true talent. And the true talent level's good, not great.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I don't know that you can roll in without at least an Alex Lyon caliber dude.
Yeah, no, you have to have some sort of plan in place. And whether it's Kevin Lankinen or you identify people that you think you can get for cheaper than Kevin Lankinen or a better fit or whatever it is, you have to have some plan in place for dealing with the Demko uncertainty. And, you know, I think the other thing with Thatcher Demko is, and again, we'll see his health status, and if we get an update today and maybe it's not, you know, maybe they fully expect him to be ready for the game against Vegas on Saturday. We'll see what the case turns out to be. But if there are these continued questions, you know, as we look ahead to the playoffs, I think it also has to affect how you see what this team's ceiling. Because I think if you were going to kind of propose the absolute most bullish case for the Canucks this year, okay, here's why I think the Canucks can go on a deep run in the playoffs, a big key to your argument would be Thatcher Demko gets hot.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, that is a ceiling-raising thing for this team that exists. But if there are these major questions about his ability to stay healthy for the remainder of this year, you kind of have to discount that factor when you're looking ahead to the playoffs. And that has implications for what you do at the deadline, right? That has implications for how you approach negotiations with your UFAs for, okay, are you trying to sell Brock Besser but then bring in someone else? If you don't think you're getting, if you're not certain you're getting like high-level Thatcher Demko starts in the playoffs, whether because of injury or form, I think that should make you way less interested in buying going into this deadline, right? Not that they're going to be traditional buyers anyways, but even if you're like, we've talked about, okay, sell Brock Besser and then use some of those assets on the cheap replacement. Well, if you're not getting the best version of Thatcher Demko, like, does even that make sense going into the deadline? I'm not saying it doesn't,
no,
but I think it changes how you look at even what you're accomplishing this season, let alone going on beyond that to next year.
Well, there's a sort of interesting dynamic, I think, just generally at play here, right, with the Canucks, where, and I think it's actually crystallized when you think about the Brock Besser situation, the Pugh Suter situation, mm-hmm, Derek Forbert, Noah Juulsen, Kevin Lankinen. And there's an awful lot about where the Canucks are positioned right now that I think heavily favors a patient approach, right? exercising the sort of patience that this organization is congenitally allergic to would probably make sense given the following facts. This team is likely to make the playoffs, but is clearly not a contender, and with where they're positioned, is looking at Vegas, Winnipeg, or Edmonton, right?
Mm-hmm.
Almost certainly a top five opponent in the very first round. Quinn Hughes is dinged up, right? At the very least, the fact that he's an option, for example, for Thursday for the U.S. is a good sign, but we know that Quinn Hughes is dinged up and has been playing dinged up for a while, both in terms of his hand and now some sort of lower body injury that he's been working through that caused him to withdraw from a tournament that meant an awful lot to him.
Yep.
So you know it's relatively serious, not like severe or anything, nothing to worry about from a Quinn Hughes is going to miss more time perspective, but something that he's going to be playing through probably for the balance of the season. Thatcher Demko, obviously, is shrouded in a ton of injury uncertainty. Elias Pettersson is a shadow of himself.
Who knows?
Yeah, who knows? And so you put all of that together, and like, what's the justification for going in on this team? It's pretty hard to come up with, frankly, Jamie. And yet, they are likely to make the playoffs. We know that this organization has to prioritize the short term. And more than that, you know, it's not like they can go seller mode, given the importance of appealing to Quinn Hughes across the next 16 months before he hits his extension-eligible summer and gains that good pre-agency leverage, which is going to be a vital moment in the history of this franchise and the future of this franchise. So, you know, it's not straightforward in terms of what this team can and has to do and how they have to look at this. Like, they do have to meaningfully keep their eye on the short term, even if everything is sort of pointing in a direction. Now, the Canucks don't ever need to be told that they need to keep an eye on the short term. They loved that, just organizationally always have. So how they navigate that, I think, is fascinating. And then how it breaks down and applies to Brock Besser, for example. Like, the Brock Besser one is probably the most interesting one to me when you really think about it, because it's like, what does this team need more than anything else? Goals.
Yeah.
And shots.
Yep.
Well, Besser helps you do both, right? He's 28. He's not 40. He's not even 32.
He's not 33. Yeah.
Yeah. He's 28. He's well-liked. He's hardworking. He's you know, not a defensive stopper by any means, but he's trusted enough to play at the top of the lineup. He's versatile enough to help you in multiple positions on the power play. And yet, so, like, that should be a no-brainer to try and keep. And yet, you know, I'm curious because, look, if the Canucks wanted to make it a priority, would they have signed both Pettersson and O'Connor before we, you know?
We've seen how they act when they have a priority UFA. Like, I even go back to Andre Kuzmenko.
Yep.
Right? That was done a month, more than a month out from the deadline. You know what I mean?
JT Miller versus Bo Horvat.
Yeah.
They get stuff done quick when they want to get stuff done.
Yeah.
Organizationally speaking. And the fact that they haven't with Besser, I think, does speak volumes. And what it tells me is, if you're talking about Besser at 8.5 times 7 or 8, that might exceed the club's risk tolerance. And fair enough. But if that's the case, right, if you're not going to be able to ink him, you're going to need every single asset with exchange value that you can get your hands on, because you're effectively going to go into the summer looking to replace, well, not replace, because that's an unfair word to use to whatever top two line center that the Canucks are able to bring in. They're not going to be a JT Miller replacement,
sure.
But you're going to need to replace Besser. You're going to need a top line forward and a top six center.
Yeah.
In the summer.
That's a lot of business.
That's a lot of business. Like, you have to have a lot of buying power if you're going to have a realistic shot of pulling it off. And you know, the Lekkerimäki factor, he had another run of strong games in Abbotsford here and is beginning to be a really exciting prospect. I don't mean a really exciting prospect like an exciting hockey prospect. Like, it's an exciting prospect for this hockey club.
Yes, that they have him coming.
You can credibly slot him into this lineup over the next year. But you don't want to throw him into Besser's minutes.
No, he can't be it just as whoever they acquire at center, you can't say, well, he's the JT Miller replacement. He's not going to be the Brock Besser replacement, because he's not going to do all the stuff that Brock Besser does. He might score 25 goals next year for the Canucks, like in a super, you know, a really good case scenario. But that doesn't mean
he's going to be a really good case scenario.
But that doesn't mean he's going to do all the great defensive work and all the matchup stuff that Brock Besser does.
No,
right?
Well, and you're not going to be putting him in a position to succeed, frankly, if you're asking him to.
No,
right? You want him to work his way up and demand that over the course of a season, and then go into next season counting on it, right? Like, You're still 12 months away from him being anything like a credible replacement to Besser, not simply because of his abilities, but because of what it takes to get him there.
Yes.
Right? And so, you know, you sort of put that all together, and it's just like, man, this is going to be a wildly difficult balancing act for this organization to sort of manage. And increasingly, I guess, you know, a test, a meaningful test of the resolve of this organization. Like, their plan to compete immediately with this core group, Jim Rutherford's opening press conference sort of characterizing, we've got players, they're better than even people think. Okay?
Yeah.
That plan is over. Like, that era is over, right? Miller's already gone. Horvat's already gone. Demko, we don't know what's going on exactly with his health at the moment, but we're certainly nervous about it. Pettersson, we don't know what's going on with his game at the moment, but we're certainly nervous about it. And then Quinn Hughes is, you know...
is Quinn Hughes. He's incredible.
He's like the hockey version of Dr. Manhattan. He's all over the ice all at once.
Yeah.
So that, I mean...
Hopefully he's not like, what's the line? He's tired of the humans. And all.
Yeah. Like, yeah.
When he's
tired
hanging out on Mars.
Yeah. Yeah. They're too complicated.
Yeah.
So you sort of put that all together, and it's just like, this is a different era. This is a new era for the Canucks. And... you know, finding a way, honestly, to be competitive this year with what you have, to like, accept. I think that Derek Forbert, for example, needs to become a fourth-round pick, and then Noah Juulsen, if he can become a fifth. It's not a great pick, but it's something you can throw into a trade later.
Yep.
Right? Pugh Suter, that's the one that gets complicated for me.
Yeah, Pugh Suter's an interesting one, especially considering the center issues already.
100%.
Like, you're already looking for help at center. Pugh Suter's a really important player for you. How much does it undercut what you're trying to do just to, like, be credible in the playoffs if
totally.
You move him?
Oh, yeah.
And what's the return going to be also? Because Pugh Suter's not – he's not that classic guy, like, type of player where you look at it and say, like, oh, he always goes for a lot at the deadline. You know what I mean?
No.
Well, he might not go for a lot at the deadline.
The issue that you're going to bump into with Pugh Suter as a sellable asset is that he has more real hockey value than he has exchange value.
Yeah.
Because he doesn't fit into any sort of box that people... But what he does is he helps you win games and plays elite defense. And that's super valuable, especially for a team that's thin at center as it is. He also scores a lot. Like, he scores a lot of goals for a player who logs the sort of
with
minutes and
usage.
Plays the sort of role that he plays. You know, he's outscored most of the comparable, like, third-line centers that you'd sort of point to and that make a ton of money. Guys like, you know, J.P. Pageot and on and on. So, I don't know. I mean, I guess that was also, like, just let me know if this is unfair, but that was partly my reaction to the Drew O'Connor contract, which was like, if you could get Suter done at 2.5, and probably you couldn't. It's probably an extra million on top of that. Like, I would have rather seen that. Just in terms of...
Well, I guess what... It doesn't preclude the
no,
other.
No, it doesn't. They,
you know
they
what
have
I mean?
A ton of flex.
But so I do wonder, and I mean, we've spent so much time talking Kevin Lankinen, talking Brock Besser, and, you know, getting the updates from Dhaliwal, and is the agent doing cartwheels? Like, we don't know. Is Pugh Suter's agent doing cartwheels? We don't know, right? Like, we haven't heard anything about where negotiations stand or even how the Canucks are kind of viewing that situation. But as you say, like, it is an important one.
Some smart team is going to come correct with, you know, three or four years, I'd expect $3 to $3.5 million at least. He's just very, very clearly worth that.
I just think where you're already where you are at center for the Canucks, and it's not like you have a Lekkomäki equivalent or a Volander
at
center.
It's Bluger and Atu Ratu.
So
and Neil Zaman.
You're thin at that position organizationally. You're looking to add at the top of your lineup already. Having a guy around like Pugh Suter, and especially because, okay, even if your quest for a center goes really well or center depth goes really well in the summer and you land a top six guy and, hey, maybe something else becomes available and you get a really good third line center, well, great, you just move Pugh Suter to the wing. You know what I mean? He has the versatility where it's not as if signing him forecloses other options, other team building options for you. He's so versatile. You can just play him wherever. Man, he's just such a handy guy to have around. Like, I don't know. It's interesting that we haven't heard anything really about how the Canucks are viewing it, but if they could get that deal done before the trade deadline, I think that'd be a big deal.
So, I mean, we have heard one thing, which is that on the Suter and Forbert file anyway, I do think the Canucks view those players as returning a meager enough return that the club would certainly consider using them as own rentals.
As own rentals, yeah.
Now, I don't have a huge issue with that, given that this club exists right now, straddling the near term and the future.
Especially not with Suter for me. Well, Suter to me is like the one I have no problem being own rental, keep him for the playoffs, and not that that means you're not going to extend him, but just like give yourself some extra time to try to extend him.
Because he's not going to, like, it's one thing if some team calls you and offers you a late first, you got to take it.
Yeah.
But you're probably getting a second or a third max. And at that price, I might rather have a credible team going into the playoffs to see if, you know, what we can do with our defensive structure and this new look blue line and on and on. And as you say, right, doesn't preclude me from having contract talks with a guy who, by all indications, really likes it here. Right up until July 1 if I have to. So, yeah, I agree with you. Suter's the guy that I think you should feel most comfortable maintaining as an own rental, and I'd add Lankanen into that list because I just don't see a world where...
Well, especially with the in-season goalie trade market at the deadline specifically.
No, but if Edmonton calls and offers you a second or Carolina calls and offers you a second, is that even a hard decision for you? I don't think it is.
No, you keep him. Yeah.
You keep him.
Yeah, Lankanen
and Suter, I think, are the most acceptable own rentals. Brock Besser is the guy who I think the team views differently, right? He's too valuable to risk losing for nothing.
Well, because Besser at the deadline, you're talking about, like, probably a first and a prospect, right?
Yeah.
So, like, that's really significant. If you're trying to search for, like, 25-year-old centers who might become available, an extra first on a prospect is a big, big deal for your team going into the summer.
And then it comes back to the defensemen. And I think the defensemen are where the Canucks, I think, need to be more disciplined about looking to the future, right? Whether it's Forbert or Soucy, subtracting one of those guys doesn't hurt your depth and, if anything, carves out more minutes for Elias Pettersson.
Yeah.
And then Juulsen, you know, I like Juulsen as a penalty killer a lot, but I do think because of his penalty killing excellence, I think there's a chance you could return like a sixth or a fifth, right? That like classic Troy Stetcher, Jordy Benn type value for a player
100%.
With Juulsen's profile. Yep. And I think the Canucks have to be willing to do it given some of their other in-house options, including Tom Volander down the stretch. Like, defense on the blue
Mancini
line.
Mancini we haven't seen yet.
Exactly.
New guy you want to see, right? Yeah.
100%. On defense anyway, I think that's where the Canucks need to be disciplined about moving to the future, in part because it's stable, right? In part because they've done the work to really build that out. Up front, I think you have more needs and being a little bit more short-term in your focus makes more sense.
JanPro, from showrooms to stockrooms and everything in between, JanPro keeps workplaces tidy, clean, and disinfected. For a free quote, visit janpro.ca. We will be back tomorrow. Big Wednesday show, as always, with the crossover and with Jason Buchla. Looking forward to that as we continue to get hyped for Thursday's Four Nations Final, Canada and the U.S. More Canucks talk on the way tomorrow here on Sportsnet 650.